Kyle Rittenhouse says his acquittal is a victory for the Second Amendment and self-defense. He gave his first interview since being found not guilty in the shooting deaths of two men during the Kenosha protests and riots last year that happened after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse was facing five charges altogether. The jury acquitted him of all of them last week. He talked to Fox News' Tucker Carlson about what happened the night of the shootings, the lead-up to the trial, and its conclusion.
It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Wisconsin. It was the right to self-defense on trial. Right. And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers. And thank God they came to the correct verdict of a not guilty.
Many on the left, for example, say if Rittenhouse had been a person of color, the verdict, the outcome would have been different. Some legal experts have been urging people to not read too much into the verdict, saying that it only applied to this specific case and wasn't a referendum on broader issues. But our next guest says our response to the trial means a lot for the future of self-defense laws and for the value of human life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Rittenhouse verdict? Should we read it narrowly as just a verdict in this case, or does it mean something? Does it mean something wider than just what happened in that courtroom? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Ian Main is an assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. He teaches civil procedure, civil rights, and wrongful convictions. He wrote a piece on the trial for NBC News. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's good to be here. Thank you.
How do you interpret the verdict? Is it just about the Rittenhouse case, or does it go farther than that?
Of course, it's both. I mean, obviously, from defendant's point of view, it's very meaningful. And from the victims in this case, it's very meaningful. And then it's also meaningful to the nation. Lots of cases in our history have had cultural significance that have lasting reverberations as to where we are in society, what the community standard is, and how much we value life and how we expect encounters to go between people. And so that was all in the debate, and obviously in the public debate. We saw that in the social media. There's a very vigorous discussion on both sides of the equation in terms of those who are obviously wanted to see Mr. Rittenhouse be prosecuted and convicted and those who wanted to see him go free.
In that piece I mentioned, you talked about that idea of a community standard when it comes to arguments of self-defense. And you point out there's a legal standard, but when you've got a bunch of people in a jury, they are interpreting that legal standard based on community values. So you think it is very worthwhile to look at the wider implications. Can you talk a little more about that?
I don't think, my guess is that the divisions that we see in Kenosha and then in Wisconsin and then in the nation regarding Mr. Rittenhouse's trial and our approach to what we view valid self-defense to be was also reflected in the jury room. I imagine the jury was somewhat reflective, had some representation of reflecting these divisions. So the jury is us. We are the jury. I think in terms of this particular statute, there's not a whole lot of guidance for a jury. The jury is asked to determine whether or not Mr. Rittenhouse's actions were reasonable and whether his fear of great bodily harm or imminent threat of death was reasonable. And, you know, I think they probably took his age into consideration, and there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion of his age. I personally think that we should not have been prosecuting him as an adult. I think that he should have been prosecuted as a juvenile, or at least processed as a juvenile. And so for me, I was caught between two aspects. One, my deep concerns about how we approach juveniles in the criminal justice system. And then the other one is how we define self-defense, just generally for all adults, regardless of age, once you age into being an adult.
You also wrote about one outside expert brought in early in the prosecution process here, talking about self-defense claims for someone who has a firearm, being able to raise the concern that someone else might take that firearm and then use it against them or others. So that by showing up with a firearm, in effect, you may be raising your right to make a self-defense claim even more?
Yeah, I think that's apparent from the verdict. I think it was an extraordinary moment, but one that I think is deeply ingrained in the narrative of those who believe that they have a right to self-defense by carrying openly firearms in society, regardless of the situation around them. And so, yeah, I think that there is a big issue here. The expert actually said, under questioning by the prosecutor, if Mr. Rittenhouse had not been armed and was approached in the exact same way by Mr. Rosenbaum, that first incident in which this man who was suffering from mental illness threw a plastic bag and obviously aggressed, he definitely aggressed on Mr. Rittenhouse, would it have been reasonable for example, Mr. Rittenhouse at that point to use deadly force, either, let's say, through a chokehold? And the expert said no. And I thought that's an extraordinary moment. In other words, if Mr. Rittenhouse had been unarmed, from the point of view of this use of force expert, he would not have been privileged. But since he had a firearm, he was privileged to use deadly force despite facing the exact same quote-unquote threat from Mr. Rosenbaum.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hello.
Hello. He created the danger, Rittenhouse did. He's walking down the street with a long gun. He's a kid. And what I find shocking and frightening is that people that have a legitimate reason to protest the shocking shooting of that young man, now it's gone from being able to shoot black men on the street to shooting people that stand up to protest the abuse. And it seems like that's all right in this country. If you're black or you're someone that defends people that are black, you can now be shot with no consequences. It's horrifying to me.
Jordis, thanks for the call. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, those concerns resonate with me in lots of different ways. I mean, you know, I really, really resonate with those comments. But, you know, the law in Wisconsin, which was really surprising, that it doesn't permit minors like Mr. Rittenhouse at 17 years old to walk around with dangerous weapons. But if you look deeply into Wisconsin law, and this is not to push back against the caller at all, it was just who we are. I'm talking about who we are as however terrifying that might be, what is our identity, that our law right now permitted Mr. Rittenhouse to walk around at 17 years old with a long rifle, more than 26 inches in length. So he was actually permitted to do what he did. Now, of course, it's not a good idea. Anyone with maturity or empathy or any kind of racial sensitivity would not, being certainly a white young male with military garb and a gun, go into a protest regarding a previous shooting of a black male by a white cop. That's so harmful to do to a grieving community anyway. And so that aside, which I found more than troubling, that we have laws that actually permit Mr. Rittenhouse to walk around with that long gun. I was still surprised that, you know, Mr. Rittenhouse was not even detained, and maybe I wasn't too surprised, but again, troubled that Mr. Rittenhouse was not at least detained by an officer that night just because he looked so young to be carrying a gun and to check ID. And that didn't even happen. And some respect, that really reflects where we are as a society, that we have police who are, I guess, are accustomed or so accustomed to the idea that a young man like Mr. Rittenhouse has a right to carry an AR-15 around at night during protests is extraordinary to me.
Before we go back to our callers, I want to ask about the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia. Again, claims of self-defense being made by the defense team there after Mr. Arbery was pursued. The suspects pushed him off the road basically with their truck, leveled guns after him. When he tries to defend himself, they shoot him, and there's a claim of self-defense being made. We don't know yet. Of course, the jury just started deliberating today. Do you have thoughts on that case?
I do. I mean, there's some underlying similarities between that case and the Rittenhouse case in terms of the idea that for the defense, they're trying to argue that somehow that this was protection of the community against someone who's doing harm to the community. So in Mr. Rittenhouse's case, it was against arsonists and rioters and those who would burn things down and create, you know, harm to others through rioting, I guess. And then, you know, in the Mr. Arbery case, it involves three individuals who are claiming to protect the community from some kind of burglary. In fact, the defense counsel used extraordinary language, mm-hmm. The word plunder to describe what Mr. Arbery was doing. There are some differences as well. Mr. Rittenhouse, at least as to the first incident, was aggressed upon. I would not characterize the second incident involving these three other individuals as aggressing upon Mr. Rittenhouse at all. But when you look at the Mr. Arbery case, oh my gosh, I mean, he was pursued. Mm-hmm. He was terrorized by multiple people in trucks with guns. I can't believe the kind of fear he must have been going through. That was just absolutely pure aggression and violence and, you know, the racial kind of aspect to it and it being in the South, really reminiscent of vigilantes taking their matters into their own hands and just basically using their race privilege to kill a Black man. It was really, really different in that particular respect.
We're talking about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, what it means for claims of self-defense and other issues. Ian Main stays with us, Assistant Professor of Law at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a wider meaning, a wider lesson in the outcome of this trial, one you like or one you don't like? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking another look at the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse. A lot of legal experts urge people not to read too much into the verdict, saying it only applied to Rittenhouse's specific case. Others seeing wider lessons in the verdict. Ian Main stays with us, Assistant Professor of Law at UW-Madison, where he teaches civil procedure, civil rights, and wrongful convictions. Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hey, I think your guest makes a number of valid observations that go beyond the case. But to me, I think Rittenhouse now typifies the warped thinking of people who believe if they have a powerful firearm that they're invincible. He goes to this mass meeting or protest and probably suddenly realizes Wisconsin has concealed carry, and then fear takes over. And then the firearms just accelerate the damage. I frankly think he was afraid. And I don't know how he'll ever get away from the fact that two people died because of his warped thinking.
Bob, thanks for the call. What do you think of that, Ian, and the idea of the presence of firearms in this case accelerating, our caller says, the danger?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Bob said. I think it was a really rich comment. And I agree with those observations. I do think that it does accelerate and escalate the violence that was used. And again, I think because he had a firearm in the way that we are understanding self-defense these days, that he had more discretion to use deadly force against those he felt in fear of than he would have if he had been unarmed. And we can debate back and forth. I mean, I certainly would think that he would not have been aggressed upon if he hadn't had a weapon. So there's also that aspect of escalation, that the presence of weapons absolutely raise tensions and increase the possibility for violence. And so to not take responsibility for you carrying you exercising your Second Amendment right as if it doesn't have any cost to society, I think is is highly irresponsible. I think if you're going to believe that you have a right to do something, you should be really aware of the cost that it does have, not only to others, but possibly to yourself. And as to yourself, I think that Bob is right. As to Mr. Rittenhouse, I mean, he's a young kid still, and he's being propped up by adults. But at a certain point, he's going to be, you know, by himself, and for a long time, will be have to face these things that he did, and that is a huge amount of trauma and a huge weight, and it's not going to go away. And so, you know, to take these things and these narratives like self-defense and I have the right to carry and things like that is really, in the end of the day, really has a lack of empathy and maturity and vision about what really is going on. We are humans. We interact. We're very affected by someone who's next to us carrying a weapon. And it changes the way we interact with each other. And it's unfortunate that that's the direction that we're going in our society.
Thanks for the call, Bob. We'll go now to Andy in Madison. Andy, hi.
Hi. I was kind of struck by what your guest said about saying that the law does allow him to carry a weapon because it wasn't a shortened one. The law is pretty clear that they can only carry the weapon in a hunting situation. And the judge basically pretended not to understand what the word or meant. So does your guest agree that the statute was vaguely written, or is he saying that because the judge ruled this way, that's now the way of law?
Interesting. John, Ian, was this a twisted rendering, a reading of the law, or is it just a gap in the law?
Yeah, again, I agree with John as well. I think that this particular law did have some failure in its drafting, and it wasn't clear. And obviously the defense capitalized on that. And, you know, regardless of how we view this judge, I mean, all judges have bias one way or the other, but this judge in this particular situation took very seriously the judicial canon that we strictly construe criminal statutes. The prosecution made a very strong argument that we need to read statutes in a way that make sense of the statute and don't create exceptions that would swallow the rule, as this particular exception under C3 would. I understand the language and the debate over that or, but I wouldn't say that it's completely outside the, you know, a reasonable interpretation that the judge took. I don't agree with it, but I understand, you know, if I was on the prosecution, I'd be happy to argue why it only relates to hunting issues. But one could read the statute in another way, and that's how the judge read it. And it was a drafting error or not by the state legislature. I don't know.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Ian Main, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison, looking at possible wider outcomes, meanings of the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict late last week. Back to your calls now. Nadine is with us in Milwaukee. Nadine, hi.
Hi. I have three issues. First of all, now that he is found innocent, he could conceivably go to the police academy and become a police officer. And while most of our police officers are wonderful, we don't need another one who thinks that they have a license to kill. Second, I didn't hear any remorse or any accepting of responsibility in his voice. And I'm concerned that he does think he has a license to kill now and will go out and do this sort of thing again. And thirdly, I'd like to see this judge recalled.
Nadine, thanks for the call. We can only speculate about Kyle Rittenhouse's future or his, I guess, psychological state. Ian, your thoughts on the judge, people who, especially those who disagreed with the verdict, very critical of the judge's handling of the trial.
I understand that. And, you know, there was a media presence here and cameras going the whole time. Certainly what I saw as a criminal litigator, criminal law litigator, who's practicing all over the state of Wisconsin and also in high level cases like homicides, you know, there's a wide range of judging styles. I will say that I've certainly had my day where I've been on the receiving end of a judge's ire. I understand that, there was, you know, reasonable allegations of bias by this judge as to this case. There were some decisions that went well for the prosecutor, and there were some decisions that went well for the defense here. In terms of kind of the bell curve, I understand people's anger regarding this judge. I've certainly felt internally angry about the way I've been treated in the courtroom by a judge. I've certainly been screamed at. I've been screamed at in open court. I've been screamed at in chambers. I felt bad for the prosecutor for being yelled at on national TV, but the interaction itself seemed well within the bell curve. Given my experience, this is not to say this behavior is appropriate. All I'm saying is that this behavior is not outside the bell curve.
Thanks for the call. In just our last minute, Ian, do you think we need to revisit things like our self-defense laws in this country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there needs to be clear guardrails about what force can be used. I think that we should not privilege those who have firearms any more than if they had been unarmed. So I think self-defense laws should assume that the person would have been unarmed, and that as an unarmed person, would they really have thought there was going to be a deadly threat? So it would be imagining Mr. Rittenhouse again without having the AR-15. Would he have been privileged to use deadly force? If he had not, then in my thinking, he should not be privileged. I don't think a gun should give you additional discretion to use violence against other civilians.
Ian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Ian Main is an assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse on murder charges and what it means for larger societal and policy questions, especially related to claims of self-defense. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, author Rax King says there's no reason to feel guilty about our guilty pleasures. She tells us why in her book, Tacky, Love Letters to the Worst Culture We Have to Offer. Find out more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, a pair of recent studies looking at white-tailed deer in Iowa and Ohio found the SARS-CoV-2 virus, that's the one that causes COVID-19 in people, in more than 30% of the deer population in each of those states. There's no evidence that deer can spread the virus to humans. There hasn't been a similar study in Wisconsin, but the state health department recommends that Wisconsin hunters take a couple extra precautions during this current gun deer hunting season. This isn't the only virus that can move between humans and other animals, and our next guest is on the lookout for germs that jump species. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about animals and the coronavirus? What concerns do you have? Are you a hunter or someone in your family or network? Have you been following this news? What do you think of the guidance, such as wearing a mask while field dressing a deer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tony Goldberg is the John D. MacArthur Chair and Professor in the UW-Madison Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine. Tony, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, we've got these studies out, not peer-reviewed, but the authors thought this could be a big deal. We're going to get it out there. What is your reaction to what you're seeing in these studies of deer?
Well, I think it's pretty scary. I mean, when SARS coronavirus 2 first emerged in people, we quickly discovered that it was most likely a bat virus that had gotten into people. So a lot of people, including myself, started to look at bats thinking, gee, what if it went from people into bats in North America? But at the beginning, nobody thought deer. So it was pretty surprising. Although some early research on the susceptibility of different animals did predict that deer might be a problem. So we should have listened more.
It seems like the scary part, as of right now, it doesn't seem like there are cases of deer to human transmission, but the idea of yet another animal, I guess, reservoir of this virus, what do we worry about there?
Well, that's right. The fear here is that white-tailed deer could be a reservoir. And by a reservoir, we mean an animal species that has enough virus in it to serve as a source of infection for us. One that most of us are familiar with is West Nile virus. It lives in birds and mosquitoes, and there's enough infected birds and mosquitoes out there that every once in a while it gets transmitted to people and makes us sick. Once you have that situation where there's another species with the virus, it becomes a whole different ballgame with respect to getting rid of it, because, you know, it's tough enough convincing people to get vaccinated, but try telling deer to get vaccinated. They certainly won't listen.
I know we have cases of virus transmission from non-human animals to humans. It's what causes a lot of our most famous diseases. It seems like the one that causes COVID-19 in humans, it can go to a bunch of different animals. I've seen cases of it being picked up in zoo animals, mink populations. It seems to spread quickly and be very hazardous there. Now, deer seem to carry it. No illness, I guess, associated with it. Is this unusual versatility for a virus?
This is unusual versatility for a virus, but not for a coronavirus. So different viral families, like the coronaviruses or the flaviviruses where West Nile belongs, or the filoviruses where Ebola virus belongs, they have different host ranges. And it's been known for a while that the coronaviruses can have a broad host range. We saw this with SARS Classic, as my friends like to say, back in 2003, when there were civets and other animals implicated in the transmission of the virus from bats to humans, and MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, and the virus that causes that is known to infect camels. So these viruses are pretty tricky in that regard.
I know one virus that we humans have managed to eradicate is smallpox. But my understanding there, Tony, is it didn't have this other animal reservoir. With a virus that can live on in so many different species, does that make the idea of eradication impossible?
Well, that kind of depends on whether or not deer turn out to be a reservoir. As the CDC and everyone is saying, there's no evidence now that deer can transmit the virus to people. But there's no evidence that they can't. All we have is lack of evidence. So if we, you know, hypothetically imagine that deer could transmit the virus to people, that is a bit of a game changer, because if we got rid of it in people, it could just come back to us from deer or from some other species. So that's a concern. The other concern is that what went into deer from people might not be the same as what could come out of deer. Viruses have this pesky propensity to evolve. So we would expect that a virus that got into deer might undergo changes and mutations and evolution and could spin off new variants that, you know, in a worst case scenario could be more harmful or even could escape immunity that we might have naturally or from vaccines. That's all speculation, but these are the sort of nightmare scenarios that are spinning around in people's heads right now.
Talking to Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Looking at news, a couple studies in Iowa and Ohio found the virus that causes COVID-19 in us people found it pretty common in deer. Talking about that and more general questions about viruses that bounce from species to species, you can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tony, I've talked to you over the years about how we try to watch for viruses and other species that might be likely candidates to cross over to humans. What is our radar like? How do we start to try to suss out among the many, many viruses out there, what likely culprits are?
That is the $64,000, or I'm dating myself, $64 million question. The ability to predict which of the millions upon millions of viruses in nature might be the next one to jump and cause a pandemic is the focus of a great deal of research right now, as you might imagine. There are new programs that the NIH and the National Science Foundation looking specifically at that. The best predictor we have right now is, are they related to something that's jumped over in the past? So SARS coronavirus 2 is related to SARS virus, which jumped over into people from bats. Influenza viruses jump over frequently from animals into people, so we can expect them to as well. Flaviviruses like West Nile virus jump from animals to people on a regular basis. So that's our best bet. But going beyond that, you know, there's all I can say is there's an enormous amount of research in every field from molecular biology to computer science trying to get at this very question.
Do we have consistent support funding-wise for this kind of research? Because I've heard tell, at least during that SARS breakout that you mentioned, people were really interested in funding research on coronaviruses in animal species. SARS went away, and maybe some of that interest did too. Do we have kind of peaks and valleys in when it comes to supporting this kind of research and analysis?
Unfortunately, we do. I kind of have a feeling we're going to have a sustained peak right now because mm-hmm. of what's going on in the world. But as you know from what you do for a living, things have news cycles. So it's difficult to perpetuate the public or the politicians' attention on certain issues. But I think we may be at a turning point with COVID-19 in that I don't think there's anybody on the planet who doubts the usefulness of being able to predict future pandemics and maybe stop them. So my hope is that we are seeing the beginning of a new era in pandemic research.
With this pandemic, there's been interest from the start in the animal origins of this particular virus. You mentioned bats. People have pointed toward pangolins. What are you watching for in the ongoing effort to figure out where this came from?
I'm watching for someone to find a population most likely of bats that has a lot of a virus that is very similar to SARS coronavirus 2, if not identical, and yet they're healthy, because that would be evidence of a reservoir. So I'm in the bat camp for sure. We know of many viruses in bats that are very similar to SARS coronavirus 2, and I imagine some cave somewhere in the world where these bats are just living peacefully with this virus and not getting sick. And it was just unlucky that something happened and they were able to transmit it to a person who started the pandemic.
We're talking to Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about viruses that jump from one species to another. The species include humans, of course. After some recent research on SARS-CoV, the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19 in particular, being found in deer in neighboring Iowa and also over in Ohio, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more research on this, on deer in Wisconsin, say, in particular, since that hasn't been studied yet, as far as I know? Do you have questions for our guest about viruses that jump from other species to us humans and how that all works, how we try to detect that, maybe prevent it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're a hunter about to go out hunting, are you going to follow the guidelines to wear a mask? Not while you're out hunting itself, but while you are dressing the deer you are hoping to get. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about deer and other animals carrying the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 in us humans. Tony Goldberg is with us, professor of epidemiology in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
I want to say, Tony, what are you, nuts? What did we just go through? Where millions of people died all over the globe. There, you have positive words for coronavirus going away. It's morphing. It's changing. It's never going to go away. There's a lot of experts who say it's going to be a human companion for the rest of our lives and beyond. No, stop playing with viruses that may protect us in the future. Will they leak? And there's other accidents. How far are we ahead now?
Oh, I think I see where you're going, Jim. Tony, Jim, I think worried about if we're researching the virus, we risk exposing ourselves to whatever the next virus might be.
Well, there is that concern. And thanks, Jim, for the call. I would say that I agree with you. Most scientists think that we're not going to get rid of SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes COVID-19, very quickly or at all. And in fact, there are about 20 to 30 human respiratory viruses that have evolved to become sort of mild, like the common cold virus. But almost all of those, if not every single one of them, began as a virus of animals. So it's just a fact of how we live as people and a fact of life on this globe that we interact with animals. So there's a certain level of risk that is just a baseline for contracting new viruses from animals. And they often evolve into human pathogens over time, but that's a long process. So I agree with your sentiment. And I would say that in terms of going out and studying them, we finally are at a point in human history where we have the tools and the knowledge to get out ahead of these things. So I think now the benefits of finding the next one before it hits outweigh any risks that we may pose by going out into nature and looking.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We got an email from Mary who says, critters like rodents, fox, raccoons, and coyotes can feed on deer carcasses and frequent the same areas as deer. Are these animals at risk of infection from eating deer, or would it only spread through the air between animals? So other mammals in the neighborhood of deer, do we have a worry there, Tony?
Great question. This is one of the things very much on the minds of epidemiologists and wildlife biologists. We are fearful that this may not be just a deer thing. We already know, for example, that mink can get SARS coronavirus 2 and can transmit it and get sick from it. And there's plenty of mink in the woods where there's deer, and they would very happily eat a deer carcass. What we don't know is whether consumption of infected deer meat can cause infection in the animal that eats it. We think that the mode of transmission of this virus in the overwhelming majority of cases is respiratory and through aerosol, so sneezing, coughing, stuff like that. But, you know, I wouldn't eat certain types of meat from a deer that I knew was infected with COVID just out of an abundance of caution. So, I think that we're going to see experiments and field studies looking at this question exactly. But, it's plausible to imagine that other animals in the woods of Wisconsin or elsewhere might contract the virus.
Talking to Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, looking at viruses that cross from one species to another with new research finding the virus that causes COVID-19 in humans, finding it in deer populations in Iowa and Ohio, not studied yet here in Wisconsin. Still time for your calls with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. We heard from Tom in northern Wisconsin who couldn't stay on the line. Tom wants to know how the virus could have been passed to deer in the first place. I don't think we have a solid answer on that, Tony. What kind of things would we be looking for, though?
That's a great question. And these are all great questions because they're all the big questions people are asking. One thing I got to say is that the paper that inspired this recent cycle of news about transmission to deer showed that it didn't just happen once. It actually happened multiple times in deer in Iowa. So it wasn't just a single isolated event. So we have to think of something that people frequently do. It's rare, as I'm sure you agree, that to be like standing in the supermarket checkout line with a deer. Mm-hmm. So it's not something like that. It's open to question, but my guess is that it's probably something that's transmitted through the environment in rare cases. So if I were to sneeze or cough or spit in the woods, and a couple of minutes later, a deer comes by and sniffs it, that could do it. People have talked about water. Maybe there's contaminated water and deer might drink it. So we're really not sure. But there's plenty of examples in nature of human viruses that move to animals, including respiratory viruses. And even though we never really know exactly how it happens, it does seem to happen.
Go back to our callers now. Todd is with us in Madison. Todd, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Todd?
My question is, as a deer hunter, I haven't gotten one yet, but are there any precautions you would recommend after you harvest the deer for processing it in the field, gutting it, perhaps skinning it, and preparing it for butchery?
Todd, that's a great question. And Tony, I pulled this up from the Department of Health Services there. They suggest, in addition to the usual hygiene you'd want, wearing a mask while doing that field dressing, limit cutting into and handling the deer's lungs, throat, and mouth nasal cavity, so respiratory system, limiting that to only what is necessary. And if you're immunocompromised, consider asking for assistance with carcass processing and handling. Tony, what do you think of that advice? Maybe an abundance of caution, but what do you think?
Yeah, I have the same website right up on my screen in front of me, Rob, because I anticipated this question. That's a good question. First of all, hope you get a deer. Second of all, what's going on right now is that DHS is recommending measures that are general hygiene measures out of an abundance of caution. So if I were out field dressing a deer, I would wear a mask because, you know, I'm a risk-averse epidemiologist. The other thing is, you know, just I think generally being aware of germs. It's not just SARS coronavirus 2. There's bacteria, there's other viruses. You know, we all know about chronic wasting disease, and we have to be careful about that. So I think just keeping a mindset that you want to minimize direct contact with tissues and bodily fluids, as we say, of deer, that you want to wash your hands thoroughly when you're done, that you want to cook your meat thoroughly, and that you want to avoid certain organs or parts of a deer are all good things, even without SARS coronavirus 2 in the picture.
Todd, great question. Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. John is with us in Oconomowoc. John, hi.
Hi. I am calling. I'm a dairy farmer, and we have vaccinated dairy cattle for rotacorona for about 30 years or more. And I'm curious if that offers coverage for COVID-19 or if COVID-19 is too specific or the vaccine not specific enough. Furthermore, I'm curious if the deer are actually getting COVID-19 or just rotacorona virus in general.
John, thanks for the call. Tony.
Good. Great questions, John. First of all, as for your second question, the deer are not getting sick or at least not getting very sick. Even in experimental infections of deer, they just kind of get maybe mild respiratory signs. And we're certainly not hearing reports of deer running around the woods, coughing and sneezing and wheezing. So they're not getting sick. As to your question about the cattle coronaviruses, that's a really interesting one because people may not realize that there are many coronaviruses of domestic animals that we already know about. You mentioned the bovine variant. There's a feline one in cats. There's canine ones, porcine ones, and pigs. The bad news is, in answer to your question, no. A coronavirus like the cattle one would be different enough from SARS coronavirus 2 that it almost certainly would not offer cross protection, as we say. The good news is that cows are a species that doesn't look from their genetics like they're going to be very susceptible to the virus. Now, you never know because it's not just genetics, but they didn't come up as super high risk in the initial analyses like deer did. So we can hope that SARS coronavirus 2 is going to leave Wisconsin's dairy industry alone.
Tony, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us. That's Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about coronavirus in different species. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, gas prices up, especially compared to a year ago, not the highest in recent memory. We'll find out what's driving those prices, that and more tomorrow on Central Time.